Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Noah Kageyama is a performance psychologist on faculty at the Juilliard School and is the performance psychology coach for the New World Symphony. He is the author of the very popular blog and weekly podcast, which I'm a big fan of, The Bulletproof Musician. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Joel.
I think your musical journey is fascinating. And on your podcast and blog, you cover so many of the topics that we've been attempting to address on this podcast. So we wanted to have a chance to introduce you and your wealth of expertise to our audience. Now, you started the violin at 2 years old, performed as a soloist with multiple orchestras while growing up, appeared on TV and radio many times, attended top-tier music schools, Oberlin, Juilliard, Indiana. All indications were that you were poised for a successful career in music. How did you end up going from that trajectory to a career path that maybe didn't even exist when you were in school?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. And there's probably like a really, really long version of the story and like a medium and a shorter version. I'm not sure what we'll end up getting. But essentially, I just started so young, like a lot of other young musicians. You don't think about what you want to do when you grow up when you're 3 years old, 2 years old. And so I just started and went along with whatever was in front of me. And practicing was always a struggle for me from the time I was little. I don't remember a time when I gladly practiced. And that's probably very similar for most people. But I mean, I went to some pretty extreme lengths, I think, to avoid practicing. I think I tried running away from home into the woods where we lived a few times. My mom packed me a lunch and set me off on my way and expected me to come back eventually and practice. I did come back because I think I needed to use the bathroom or something and ended up with poison ivy. You know, so all these sorts of things happened. And when I went to Oberlin, honestly, I think some people know this story. In order to get out of orchestra, I decided I could add a second major, like pretend to do the double degree program there. Mm-hmm. And that was partly to avoid extra practicing and so forth. And so, yeah, I actually pretended to be a psych major during my 4 years there and also pretended to be a music major at the same time and ended up graduating with just the psych degree, but not really having any particular interest in psychology. Like I slept through a lot of my classes and got pretty mediocre grades and didn't really study very much and kind of skated through 4 years of straddling the line between being a musician and not a musician, and fully intended to go down the music path. And so I went to Juilliard for my master's, and there was no avoiding practicing in orchestra at that point. And so that's when I started asking myself whether this was something that I actually wanted to do. And, you know, I was happy to be there and to be around friends that I'd known from summer festival. And so parts of it were great, but then I started seeing the end of school coming up soon. I was like, well, what am I going to do when I finish? Am I going to teach? Am I going to take orchestral auditions? Am I going to be in a chamber music group? Am I going to freelance? Like, I didn't actually want to do any of those things. And I was having a conversation with some friends that I was in a quartet with, and we were all talking about what we'd do if we won the lottery. And to my surprise, the three of them had ideas on what they would do if they won the lottery after buying a Ferrari and a loft in Soho and, you know, a Strat right. And those kinds of things. They all had ideas that involved being a musician, whether it was starting a recording label or all these things that related to music. And I didn't say anything to them. I was like, huh, well, that's weird. Why wouldn't you quit? You don't have to be a musician anymore. And so I realized that my thinking in this department was a little bit atypical. And so I was having a conversation with my then girlfriend, now wife, who's a pianist. And she said, yeah, you know, you don't have to become a musician just because that's what you've always done. And she kind of gave me permission, as it were, to like actually open my mind to considering other things. And I honestly had no idea what I would do. I just knew that I would quit if I won the lottery and do something else. But I didn't know what that something else was. And around the same time, I was taking this class that Don Green was teaching at Juilliard. on performance psychology, and had never come across performance psychology, even as a psych major in undergrad. It just wasn't on my radar at all. And I thought it was actually kind of fascinating on an intellectual level, but also really practical and useful personally for my own performing and competitions and so forth. And I entered this one international competition around the time I finished that class. And again, couldn't bring myself to really practice and prepare for the competition like I should have. And ended up having to utilize a lot of these mental skills that I had learned in the class with him in order to be able to avoid embarrassing myself on stage when I got to the competition, and ended up playing better than I had any right to play in the first round and passed on to the second round. And even in the second round, played way better than I should have. But finally, my not being prepared caught up to me, because I mean, when I say not prepared, like, I hadn't learned the third movement of the Nielsen Concerto. There was a piece, the Wieniawski Polonaise, that I'd played when I was a kid, but hadn't touched since then, that who knows how that would have gone if I had to play it. And so I was really like not able to go on to the next round, even if I had played it well enough to pass. And like, you know, the Bach Chaconne, I discovered the night before that, wait, you know, I've never played this through without the music. Is it actually memorized? And then I tried, and it turns out it wasn't. And so like I had the CD player on repeat all night long as I was sleeping, hoping that it would go in there. And it turns out that was probably part of my undoing. Like I thought it was at the end of the Chaconne and I played the last chord, only to discover halfway through the chord that that wasn't the last chord. So I had to kind of wander around for a little while to figure out where I was. So in any case, all this to say, I played better than I really should have. And my experience, despite not being prepared, was a really positive one. Like on stage, I was really engaged. I was kind of in the zone, as it were, and thought I played pretty well. And so all of this kind of led me to realize, you know what, maybe being a musician isn't really what I'm most interested in. Because I was really intrigued in this performance psychology thing, and I didn't know where it would go or what was possible. Like you said, it wasn't really a career that was on my radar or was really something that existed that people aimed towards. But, you know, I got to talking to Don Green after class and asked him what his work and his career looked like. And I was like, well, that seems kind of interesting. I don't know if it's possible for me or what's going to happen, but I do like being in school, and that would enable me to avoid making a decision about what to do when I grow up. And I was kind of intrigued by performance psychology. So I was like, well, let's pursue that and then see what happens when I get to the end of that. And so yeah, my wife was going to Indiana. I was like, oh, Indiana has a good school. They have psychology and there's musicians there. That seems like a good place to go. And so I went there and I applied, and yeah, so that one thing leads to another, and now I'm here talking to you, but I don't know, maybe it's the medium length story of how I got to be where I am right now.
You didn't necessarily know that you'd end up on the path that you did, but counseling psychology was the degree that you ended up getting. Was there actually a performance psychology degree, or is that something separate?
So there's actually a book now. There was then as well. There's a book now. It's an online directory of all the graduate programs that exist in the area of sport and performance psychology. And Indiana did have a master's program in sports psychology, but they didn't have what they do now, which is an actual full-fledged official minor in performance psychology that goes along with the counseling psychology degree. So at the time, I just kind of created my own. It was basically a counseling PhD, relatively traditional counseling PhD, along with a specialization that I created in sport and exercise science.
So were you considering at that point that maybe you would be opening up a private practice, or was that not actually on your radar either?
I don't know that I had any clear ideas on what life would look like after the PhD program. I think I didn't want to overthink it. And I just knew that this was something that intrigued me, and I could, again, like I said, prolong the decision or any thoughts about what my life should actually look like for a few more years. And yeah, so I think looking at Don's life and career, it seemed like a private practice could be part of the equation. So that was, I think, enough for me to be like, yeah, let's see where this path goes and I'll figure it out as we go. Doesn't sound like the most responsible thing, I think, to do, and probably freak my parents out, but I think it's pretty much where I was at the time.
I guess it probably doesn't sound any less responsible than telling your parents you're going to become a professional musician if your parents don't know anything about the music business.
Could be, yeah.
So you get your PhD, and then what happens after that? How did you end up on faculty at Juilliard? Is that the first time that a performance psychologist has actually been on faculty, or was that what Don Green was actually doing at Juilliard when you were taking his course?
Yeah, that was what Don was doing. And Don's really the first performance psychologist to come out of sports and work with musicians in a more serious, devoted kind of way. I think performance psychologists have worked with musicians, and there have been some who've been really focused on non-traditional populations, like non-athletes. But I think Don's the first one who really kind of said, you know what, this is a population that could use what's available here, wrote for musicians, worked with musicians, and so forth. So yeah, after school, you know, honestly, I don't know, again, I don't know what I was expecting, but I think there was some part of my mind that was like, you know what, I'll finish school, I'll have a fancy PhD to put behind my name, and somehow musicians are going to find me and ask me to help them and give me money to help them. And that wasn't, of course, how it worked out, because even when you finish school and get your PhD, it turns out if you want to be able to call yourself a psychologist and be official, there's a whole process for that. You're not done when you get the degree. You actually have to accumulate a certain number of supervised clinical hours under supervision. You need to sit for the licensure exam and so forth. So all that required more time. So I think it was another, I don't know, 2 or 3 years after I finished defending my dissertation that I was working in a group practice, accumulating supervised hours and so forth, and then studying for the licensure exam before I could officially call myself a psychologist and practice independently on my own. And so even when that happened, I was like, okay, well, now people are going to just find me and and so forth. And that turned out not to be true either. So I continued to work at the group practice and gaining a lot of really valuable experience working with non-musicians in a very typical sort of clinical population with depression and anxiety and so forth. But that wasn't why I put down the violin. I wanted to work with high-level performers, whether they be musicians or athletes. But honestly, I really did want to work with musicians. I think that was always my focus, even after I left Juilliard. And I wasn't sure how to make that happen. Uh-huh. And so, you know, Don continued to be really instrumental in trying to help me cultivate that part of my career and took me to some conferences and took me down to New World really early on when I was finishing up school and tried to help get me opportunities to start getting my feet wet working with musicians. So that's partly how Juilliard came to be. And that, you know, we had done a couple things, Don and I together with Juilliard online, even back when Skype was the only game in town, and that barely worked. Worked with some students and, you know, did some coaching to see if that was a viable program to do remotely. And then Ginny Allen was one of the deans at the time, a good friend of Don's. And she had me come in during the summer once to do a conducting workshop or a workshop with conductors on performance psychology. And she, honestly, she's the one that was instrumental in bringing me on faculty and getting me set up there. Because I think Don had moved to the West Coast and didn't seem like he was coming back east anytime soon. And so, yeah, so a variety of little tiny things that couldn't really have been planned and had really nothing to do with me that ended up leading to my being able to, you know, teach in that capacity at school.
And let's talk about that then. When you're at Juilliard, what exactly are you doing there? What's your day and week look like?
So when I started out, it was just one class for grad students on performance psychology. And then I think I started teaching a couple pre-college classes, maybe a year or two later, and then I started evening division. And now I've, as of this year, I think I've, maybe it was this year, I've kind of taken a break from pre-college and no longer am teaching an evening division. And it's now just 2 grad classes at Juilliard. But essentially, my work there is focused on big day of teaching these classes that revolve around how to play more effectively under pressure and how to practice more effectively for those kinds of moments and all the sorts of things that you've read about or listened to on the blog, but condensed into a one semester class.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's fantastic. I wish I could take that class. Actually, it turns out I can though take something. Is it the same class or is it something similar? What are you offering online to people in my situation? Because I've read a little bit about that.
Yeah. So pre-pandemic, it was basically a self-study version of the class that I teach at Juilliard that's available online, because I kind of developed that online self-study class and the Juilliard class in tandem, like at the same time. It was during the same year I was preparing to teach that I was cultivating these slides and these stories and collection of studies that I wanted to share and so forth. So yeah, there is like an online version of the class that I teach at school. And since the pandemic, though, I've started discovering that Zoom actually works pretty well for teaching remotely. Uh-huh. In some ways better than live, because people are a lot less inhibited when they're in their own little Zoom room and they could try things out while muted. Once everybody's in the same classroom live and having to play and they know other people can hear them, it tends to be a little bit more inhibiting in terms of really kind of trying new things. But yeah, so now I've started teaching online classes, that like a 4-week class, like a 6-week class for teachers specifically and so forth, that get at a lot of the same skills that we work on at Juilliard during the semester, but just in a more condensed online sort of format.
Is that a asynchronous learning, or is it all at the same time on Zoom, right?
Yeah, like the live classes are synchronous. So we meet live, we do some exercises during the class session, there's homework in the weeks between. One of the classes that's more geared towards students and adult learners, there's actually a lot of recording that happens there, which everyone freaks out about at first because nobody wants to record themselves and listen. And they have to share the recordings with the group, which everyone's even less excited about. But at the end of the day, they end up, I think, being grudgingly willing to do so, and often grateful that they were nudged a little bit to do that.
So people are recording themselves playing as part of the class.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Which, anyone who's listening, that's going to totally scare them off. And so I don't advertise that very much. But yeah, it's people record like 10-second snippets, 20-second snippets. And I shouldn't say the conditions surrounding the recording, because that's going to put people even more off from the idea of doing this. But essentially, it's a before and an after, right? So everyone records a before of 20 seconds of something, and then they'll use a particular practice strategy or a particular mental strategy on that 20 seconds of music during the course of the week. And then they'll record another version at the end of the week to see what has changed. And when people upload it, I have people who play different instruments listen in and comment just to see what they notice, right? Because a lot of times we're kind of blinded. Like, we can only hear the things that sound bad to us. It's really difficult for us to notice or acknowledge the things that have changed and improved. And when people hear other people saying they notice some of the same things that have gotten better, it kind of makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside. And it helps you start to see the things that are evolving and changing in your own playing when other people are giving us that feedback.
So. That sounds great. And that's available for students and teachers, right? But they're different courses.
Yeah, there are often educators and teachers and professional musicians who sign up for the, quote, learner version as well. And so I certainly don't exclude them, but it tends to be divided a little bit between students and adult learners and educators and professional musicians for the educator version.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about your podcast, because it's really a treasure trove of information for students and teachers who are looking to continually improve their practice skills. And after all, we all know that the more you can learn about how to teach yourself, the better chance you have at success, since we usually only see our teachers about 1 hour a week. And you cover such topics as beating anxiety, building confidence, cultivating courage, effective practice strategies, getting into the zone, and mental resilience. One of these topics that we've touched on in this podcast a little bit is performance anxiety. So what kind of advice could you share with our audience to help them with this? Because I really think it's one of the biggest issues that so many of us deal with as professionals, and it seems to go hand in hand with developing good, solid practice skills.
Yeah, you know, this is a tricky one, because I think the answer that's actually most helpful is not the one that most of us want to hear, which is, I think we all want, I mean, at least I certainly did, I wished there was a way to be as calm on stage as I was in the practice room. And then I felt like, oh, if that's the case, then everything will just go swimmingly well and I'll be well in the world and so forth. It turns out it's actually a little more involved and complex than that, but in a way that gives us more tools in order to handle it. So at the end of the day, I think we tend to obsess over the physical things that we experience, right? Like, we get sweaty, our hands get cold, our heart rate goes crazy, feel the butterflies in our tummy and so forth. It's very distracting, yes, but that's what psychologists would call somatic anxiety. It's the physiological response to pressure or to a particular situation. There's also a cognitive element, or cognitive anxiety. This is like the doubts and the fears that pop into our head, worrying about the audience, worrying about messing up, worrying about what our teachers will say, what the people behind the screen might be doing or thinking, what's going to happen if we don't win this job. And it's the one time in the last 10 years this position has opened up and so forth. That actually seems to be more detrimental to performance than the physiological stuff that happens, even though we tend to obsess over the physiological. So essentially, it helps for us to separate out the somatic component of anxiety from the cognitive component, because there are different things that we can do to address each of them. And they each have a different relationship with performance as well, where it seems that the physiological stuff, like feeling zero physical activation, is probably not ideal for playing our best. Like if we're completely chill and calm and almost tired and apathetic, that tends not to be associated with our best performances. But also if like we're bouncing off walls and have way too much energy, like we've just had too much coffee and so forth, that's also probably not great for performing well also. So like a moderate amount of this sort of physical activation does seem to be optimal for performance. However, when it comes to cognitive anxiety, the less the better. Instead of it being like an upside down U, with cognitive anxiety, it's like a straight line, right? The less worried, the less doubt, the less second guessing, the less mental chatter and analysis and so forth that we're experiencing up in our mind, the better performances are likely to be. And the more of that we have, the worse performance is likely to be. So we have kind of like these two different goals, both physiologically and cognitively, to accomplish. Of course, the cognitive and the physical overlap, where I feel like I've heard people call this the anxiety spiral, where essentially, you know, you're sitting backstage, feeling okay, but then you start to feel a little bit nervous. And then you start to notice that you're feeling nervous. So you start worrying about the fact that you're starting to get nervous, which makes you more nervous, which makes you worry more about that because you can't stop it anymore, and makes you worry even more. And like suddenly, like you have kind of spiraled out of control to the bad place where like you're just, now you're both mentally and physically not in a particularly good place. And so a lot of the physical strategies that revolve around breathing and releasing tension and so forth are really aimed at not calming us down, but just making sure things don't spiral out of control and we're in that Goldilocks zone in the middle somewhere. As far as cognitive control goes, that is a lot more fun, I think, to explore and to work with. But in some ways, like I guess with the physical as well, like easier said than done, like in terms of how to stay focused and how to stay in the zone and so forth. But it is relatively concrete, and you know, different musicians have talked about it in different ways. But essentially, if we can, in moments where we tend to feel nerves and anxiety, if we can figure out what exactly the most helpful thing for us to think about in that moment is, and then become much better at engaging in those types of thoughts, makes it a lot easier for us to essentially experience excitement as opposed to anxiety. Because my guess is most musicians at any level have had the fortunate experience of having a performance that might have started off predominantly with anxiety, but then at some point in the performance ended up legitimately becoming more like excitement and ended up being a positive experience. And we've, you know, all had the opposite as well, I'm sure, where start off feeling good and then suddenly anxiety, panic, and so forth takes hold. But a lot of that seems to be related to how effectively we can stay focused on things that are relevant and important and useful to performance. So for instance, worrying about the committee, or worrying about messing up, or worrying about how bad was that thing that just happened 5 seconds ago.
Yeah.
Like those are things that tend to increase our stress response in the moment. But instead, if we're able to focus on, this is one of my favorite stories that I've heard recently, Roger Tapping, you know, violist who recently passed away in the Juilliard Quartet, was talking about a particular section in a quartet that always made him a little bit uncomfortable. He could totally play it, no problem in the practice room, but you know, when there's pressure, it was tricky enough that it made him a little bit uncomfortable. So he recognized or realized at some point that if he worried about it, if he thought about the technical difficulties and that passage and his part, it would be pretty hit or miss in performance. But so long as he occupied all of his attention with what the cellist was doing at that moment, just really listening intently to every nuance, every detail of what the cellist was doing and how his part intersected with that, and really kind of not thinking at all or paying attention to what he was doing, it would go fine. So, I mean, that's kind of a tiny example of how if we can really direct our attention to places that are going to be more useful and more helpful for us performing the way that we want to in the moment, our experience of anxiety and nerves can shift more towards this feeling of excitement that's much more ideal and optimal for performing effectively.
Wow, that's such useful information. Do you work then individually with people too in the same capacity, like give a 1 hour lesson or something like that? And if so, is that with an instrument or how do you handle that?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't do a ton of one-on-one work here in the last few years and I've been cutting back. But yeah, it is a lot of essentially live experimentation, right? So people will bring their instrument in, they'll describe the sorts of things that they're finding challenging. And sometimes we'll talk about just basic practice strategies that might be useful to them, but then we'll also try things. So for instance, there's a section that kind of tricky, kind of fast. And before I get to it, I'm always worrying about it. And then if I'm worrying about it, it falls apart. So we'll try things. We'll try, you know, what else is happening in the ensemble at that moment, or what else is happening in the orchestral part or the piano part. Or we'll also talk about things that are maybe not related to other instruments, but focusing on subdividing or an internal pulse, or focusing on the larger shape of things, or focusing on just audiating different sounds, audiating the sound of your own instrument in an ideal world, or audiating vocally in your head. You know, a lot of times we've been asked to sing in lessons, and it turns out it's kind of a useful thing to do even in performance, but in our own head instead of out loud. And even thinking improvisationally, thinking about subtle nuances that one can add from moment to moment. All of these things, essentially the common factor here is that they're all oriented around forcing us to think more about what we want in the moment, as opposed to monitoring and evaluating, critiquing what's actually coming out of our instrument in the moment. Also tend to be much more focused on the present moment as opposed to the future or the past. And also the other common element is that it forces us away from analyzing or monitoring or trying to over-control the microscopic details of mechanics and technique, all of which are useful for the practice room, right? We do want to think about, oh, what's my thumb doing here? What should my third finger be doing? Or where should my elbow be when I'm shifting into this position in the practice room? But I think we all know and have had the experience of thinking about those kinds of things too much in a lesson or studio class, or audition or performance, and then suddenly finding that things fall apart when we're thinking too much about those microscopic details. And we've all had teachers tell us, right? Like, at some point, just don't think about it. Just play, let it go. Again, much easier said than done, because
for sure,
it's often hard to say what to think about instead. It's like, you know, don't think about the purple donkey. That's all we can think about once we know what not to think about. But yeah, so whether it's Roger's story or this idea of focusing on audiating sound or pulse or improvisatory details or colors or sounds or emotion words, having essentially a really clear script of thoughts to engage in that are associated with what's going to help us play most effectively from 1 second to the next, it's a huge part, it seems, of being able to play our best regardless of whatever kind of pressure or nerves we might be experiencing at that moment.
Yeah. Well, can you point out some of your specific episodes that deal with performance anxiety and talk a little bit more in depth so that people can go and check it out and get even more information than we've just shared in this podcast?
Yeah, I think one of the posts that's maybe the earliest one that I wrote related to nerves, you know, this is one of the most popular, I guess is the word for it, strategies that sports psychologists will talk about when it comes to managing nerves. And it's not aimed so much at eliminating nerves, but it's more aimed at being able to perform optimally regardless of nerves. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's a book that I know is popular with a lot of musicians called Golf is Not a Game of Perfect. This idea of having, I know a lot of musicians also play golf, and golf seems to be one of those really finicky mental type of games where you can easily screw yourself up by thinking about the wrong thing at the wrong time. And before you hit a shot seems to be the time when your mind can play games on you. And so this is where the idea of a pre-shot routine, or basically kind of like a ritual to engage in, much like you see basketball players do before shooting free throws. Bounce the ball a certain number of times, you spin it in your hands, you look at the basket, you bend your knees, and there's some kind of a ritual that is sort of unique to the individual that they go through. And it's not coincidence, or it's not an accident. I mean, coaches and players really do think about these things and work on these things and integrate them into their preparation for those kinds of moments. And it's not something they only do in games or only when it's an important free throw. They do it every single time, whether it's an important free throw or not. Uh-huh. Similarly, it's one of the first things I learned from Don Green in the class. I think it's one of the first things we went over, the idea of cultivating a pre-performance routine, whether it involves breathing or releasing tension or hearing the note in your mind before you play it or trying to remember how it feels on a good day when the bow just glides over the string or the air comes out in a particular way, depending on your instrument. There's different imagery elements that can be involved as well. But yeah, essentially, it's a post about trying to cultivate a pre-performance routine to engage in the last 10, 15, 20 seconds right before you play the first note so that, you know, you're just much more settled and more grounded and more centered and in a better place mentally, emotionally, and physically to be able to do your best.
Great. Is that a blog post, one of the earliest ones you said you wrote?
Yeah. You know, I should be able to remember what I called it, but honestly, at this point, I can't remember what it's called. I can find it for you later and send
you. You can let me know and I'll put it in the show notes.
Right.
This has been really helpful and so great to meet you and have a chance to chat with you. And everybody should check out bulletproofmusician.com because I know that's where your blog is located. And you also are under the same name for your podcast. Is there anything else that we might have missed that you'd like to share with our audience?
I can't think of anything. I think that's fundamentally a good place to start, just understanding the nature of performance anxiety and understanding the importance of attention control and having a clear mental script as well as a physical script that we've trained our body to be able to engage in.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Carly Troyer and Aspen Jacobson, who are high school seniors at the amazing Interlochen Arts Academy. We talk about their experience in the singer-songwriter program at the Academy and what's in store for them when they graduate. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.